Order, transportation policy will come to order. Listen, if you're going to be at a committee meeting elsewhere, it would be nice to check in and say, I'm going to be in room X or something so we can, we've been waiting to get a quorum here so that one of the twins could move, minutes for March 22nd and March 29th. Want me to flip the coin? Representative Seibert moves the minutes of March 22nd. We'll split them.
I totally agree.
Is there any discussion on the minutes of March 22nd? Minutes? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes of March 22nd are approved. And let's see, Representative Gazelka moves the minutes of April 6th. Is there any discussion on those? If not, all those in favor of approving the minutes of April 12th.
There we go, yep.
Wait a
second.
Well, we got April on both of these, so which do you want? Oh, excuse me.
Which one do you want?
March 22nd and March 29th. I'm on the 29th. I think we already did the 22nd.
Okay.
You got it. Any objections or whatever? If not, do I have all those in favor, please signify saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The most prevails, and the minutes for March 29th are approved. What I was going to tell you was that there was an announcement on my paper here for April 6th and April 12th. There will be no meeting on Wednesday, April 6th, and we'll meet on April 12th to hear bills. I was Representative Beard in the room, not here. Representative Hanson, is he the only one? I see him. Would you like to come forward, Representative Hanson?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Larson.
I'd like to move House File 468 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Is that
Public Safety.
Public Safety. Committee on Public Safety.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Hanson, and if you would begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House File 468 came about. I have a constituent in Mendota Heights, Michael Lynch, who would have liked to have been here today, but he was unable to, so he provided written testimony. He lives in Mendota Heights and commutes to Egan, and he did some research and discovered that he could not ride an electric-powered motorized bicycle to work. The current statute only provides for a motorized bicycle with a piston-driven engine. I know there's a lot of issues and concerns related to scooters and other electrical powered bicycles, but what this bill does is it doesn't change the definition of the power requirements. It has the same requirement. The existing statute is there. What this does is it allows an electric power source in addition to the gasoline or diesel fuel powered engine. And Mr. Lynch's written testimony is there that kind of describes the statute, and then there are some photos of electric-powered motorized bicycles. So, in summary, what this bill does is it allows electric power to power the motorized bicycle. It does not change the thresholds of power that the motorized bicycle has to meet. We did check with Public Safety. They were neutral on the subject. We checked with Minnesota AAA. They were neutral. We checked with the Minnesota Safety Council, and they were neutral.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hanson, the picture on the second page, is that the gentleman's bike that he wants to get permission to use?
Yes.
Pretty nice bike.
What?
And pretty nice bike. And just for the record, I did talk to the constituent to make sure he was not a he's not invested in these bikes. He is not a salesman for the bikes. He is just someone who wants to purchase a bike to use.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions or comments? Just out of curiosity, these are plug-in. I assume there's some kind of rechargeable batteries in that housing there somewhere.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's...
What's the running time on one of these charges?
I do not know the answer to that.
Okay. I was just wondering because some of my precincts when I was down there are really long way between houses.
Come up to the rural areas.
That's far. Yes, Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, are these allowed on the interstate? I can see, I can't imagine that it would be because of the speeds, but they aren't allowed on other than local streets, I would presume.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leader, the answer is no. There are specific mm-hmm. provisions under the statute on where they're allowed.
Any other questions or comments? If not, Representative Larson renews his motion that House File 468 be recommended to pass and really referred to public safety. All in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. House File 468 is on its way to public safety. Thank you.
Thank you.
Did Representative Beard show up? No, he hasn't. Who else is here?
I am.
Not that I was afraid of. Which one of the bills you want to take up? Do you have any preference, Representative Hopper?
Your wish is my desire.
I was hoping to save you the big bill, we have two with Beard and a couple of others, but whatever, I don't care. Which one would you like?
Mr. Chair, again, you're chair of the committee. You can make that decision.
Okay, how about 2097?
Smart choice, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair?
Representative Hulbert.
If I might, I'd like to move House File 2097 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance.
I think that works.
All right. And this is a Department of Vehicle Services bill that was brought to me, as you can see from the number, fairly late in the process. It governs issues related to motor vehicles, including registration tax refunds and a few other little minor changes, and I'm going to allow a representative from the department to give you the specifics of the bill.
Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Larry Olola. I'm the Vehicle Services Director for Driver and Vehicle Services. This bill contains a number of technical changes, the first portion of it mainly dealing with definition updates, that type of thing. The more substantial portion of the bill starts with Section 12, dealing with the refund sections. Currently, with refund, if your vehicle is permanently destroyed and the insurance company purchases the vehicle, there are essentially two provisions that if it is destroyed by a tornado or by a flood, you can receive a refund for the remainder portion of the registration tax. What this bill does is it allows for an expansion of that, so if your vehicle is destroyed, the insurance company permanently destroys the vehicle if it was damaged due to an accident or by fire or by an act of God. You are then eligible for a refund of the remaining registration tax. So it just clarifies that. Section 13 deals with a situation that we run up against. Sometimes people buy registration for their vehicles and then they maybe will take a chance. They won't necessarily put the registration on the vehicle. We'll try and operate the vehicle. If they operate the vehicle for a full year and they haven't been caught and haven't been forced to put those stickers on, they can then apply to us saying that they haven't used the vehicle, turn in the unused stickers, and receive a refund. What this section does is it allows for a refund on stickers that have been unused, but only up to the point where the registration period begins. So if you buy your registration early, and you then maybe sell the vehicle or the vehicle is damaged and it isn't into that registration period for which those stickers were purchased, the refund can be issued. If it's into the registration refund period, then only the Section 12 would apply. And then Section 14 repeals a couple of obsolete areas, one dealing with the definition and sworn statement, the other one dealing with the transfer of motors or engines on motor vehicles. Many years ago, engines were probably the primary point of identification on vehicles, and if an engine was changed, it changed the identity of the vehicle. Long since then, we have gone to a system standardized by the federal government where the vehicle identification number is located generally on the dash of your vehicle, and that is what identifies the vehicle. If you change your engine, it doesn't change the identity of the vehicle, as long as the vehicle isn't identified by the engine. So this particular repealer eliminates that need to report to us when you change your engine.
I'm looking at the bill summary, Section 12, and it talks about makes the refund equal to the registration tax for the months remaining after the month in which the place and title are returned to the department, rather than allowing the refund on 1/12 the tax for each month remaining. What is the difference?
What happens, Mr. Chair, what happens is once you get into a month, the registration is due for that entire month. So whether it's on the 1st of the month or the 30th of the month, the registration is due for the month. So when your refund starts is the beginning of the next month.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Well, would you like to renew your motion, Representative
Holder? I'm not aware of anybody that's in opposition to the bill, but maybe we should ask.
Should we ask? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify for and against the Representative Holberg's bill? Would you like to renew your motion?
Mr. Chair, I would like to renew my motion that House File 2097 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance.
All in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to Transportation Finance. I don't see any hope for us, Representative Holbrook, so you might as well go on to
thank you.
House File 2063.
Mr. Chair, if I might at this time, I'd like to just move that House File 2063 be considered by the committee. Eventually, it should move to public safety, but I think following the discussion, we'll make the determination whether it should move with or without recommendation, if that is so, the pleasure of the chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, this bill is brought to us by DVS, Department of Public Safety, and it is related to commercial driver's licenses. And it has a number of provisions in the bill that are being requested in order to conform to federal requirements. And in fact, failure to act on these measures may result in sanctions of $20 million in 07 and $40 million in 08 and beyond. In addition, there is some risk that Minnesota would be prohibited from issuing commercial driver's licenses as well. As you can see from the bill itself, I am the only person on the bill. This bill repeals the Dimler Amendment and also repeals some of the provisions we enacted last year relative to point 08 legislation that many of our constituents probably may be disappointed with, and there is no Senate companion, so I think at this point I'm only one out of 201 of us signed on it, though. We hear the Senate's hearing at 3, so somebody must have put their name on it there as well. But members, I mean, it has some tough issues, but I think the reality is, as you hear about this bill, is that the federal government does have the right, and I understand in Florida has stopped issuing commercial driver's licenses, and whether we like it or not, we do depend on the trucking industry for a lot of goods and services, and this could become very serious if, in fact, the federal government stops issuing commercial driver's licenses in Minnesota. And with that, I have a number of people that are here to testify on the bill and tell you all the wonderful details.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Vicki Albu. I'm the Driver Services Program Director for Driver and Vehicle Services. And Representative Holder has explained the necessity and the urgency for passage of the bill. The purpose is for Minnesota to come into compliance with the Motor Carrier Safety Improvement Act, and we have until September 30th of 2005 to comply. Most states in the nation have come into compliance, but many are, like us, scrambling to get their legislation passed to meet the deadline. I'm available to answer any questions that you may have, and that's why I'm here.
Representative Reeder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry I forgot your name, but commercial driver's license are recognized for every state. We necessarily wouldn't have to issue them here, isn't that correct?
Mr. Albert?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, that is true, but if Minnesota could not issue commercial driver's licenses, our residents would have to go to travel to other states to obtain licenses and testing, and it would be an inconvenience to the drivers and may impact the trucking industry. The trucking associations and Teamsters are supporting the bill.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, maybe I need to give you a little more information here. But basically the federal government is saying is that we need to conform to their standards, and those laws that we have on the books that would mask or hide driving violations by both somebody with a passenger vehicle driver's license and or commercial driver's license are no longer allowed. And so because of the fact that the Dimler Amendment hides from the record any speeding violations on a 55-mile-an-hour road up to 65 miles an hour, and because when the .08 legislation was passed, .08 and .09 violations would disappear off the record if there were no further violations in a 10-year period, and also a existing provision for those violations at .10 or higher after a 15-year clean record disappear as well. Those in the evaluation of the federal government are things that mask driving records.
Questions? Comments? Oh, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Seems like we've dealt with this issue a couple times in the past few years, and that we keep coming back to this. Now it seems like the federal government wants to basically hit us over the head with a baseball bat by saying they're going to take $20 million away from us, and if we don't do it in 07, they'll take $40 million in 08. My question is why can't the federal government come in with some kind of it's always easier to do things by sweeten it with honey rather than hitting over the head with a baseball bat, and we always are having to comply with federal law. Is there a reason that what was the precipitation for this law going into effect? Were there lots of accidents, or were there lots of violations that were precluded in the state of Minnesota or in the nation for not that this law was put in place, and now because we haven't stepped up to the ball plate as fast as they wanted us to, now they're going to hit us over the head with a baseball bat?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I can't speak to the history behind the federal regulations, but perhaps a representative from the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration is here and would be able to do so. I just wanted to add that Driver and Vehicle Services is responding to an audit. In August of 2004, the FMCSA conducted an audit of our laws and our commercial driver's license practices, and this bill is in response to all of those items that are required to be corrected to comply with that federal regulation. But if you're asking for the history behind the regulation itself, I don't think I can answer that question.
Well, then before we leave, Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. What in your history and knowledge from the state standpoint has the state had a major falling out with this legislation as far as the feds go? What have we in the state not complied with as far as have we, not met a threshold or not met some kind of a area of commitment that we, we've had so many accidents because of commercial driver's license defaults or crashes, or what is it that we've done that's been so bad that now we're, I mean, all states are being put in this place, but what else? I mean, it seems like if you have a bad actor out there, you go after the bad actor. Here, we're all bad actors according to federal law.
May I respond?
Ms. Harbaugh.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I don't believe that there is necessarily any specific occurrence that's happened in Minnesota, but I believe the concept is that everyone would be on an equal playing field throughout the country, that every state would have the same record retention for counting previous violations. And it's to prevent situations where people might go to a state that has a less stringent record maintenance requirement and potentially be licensed there and then come back into another state after they've cleaned up their record. It's a safety issue primarily, from my understanding.
So, Mr. Chair, ma'am, we've done nothing wrong. The state has done nothing wrong to say that the law was put in place because of things that we did or didn't do. There's nothing to justify it from a state standpoint.
Representative Anderson, I don't believe that the federal regulations were put into place because of any violations or misdoings on the part of Minnesota. I believe it was it's a federal initiative to improve safety on the highways and to make it consistent requirements across the board for commercial drivers in any state.
Well, I would like to hear from the federal licensed person.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, as much as I hate to bring up this point, but we at the state oftentimes make requirements of cities or counties, and we don't give them money, and we just make them do it or else. I can think of a few things since I've been here that we have imposed on local units of government. So, some of us aren't too happy about this particular piece of legislation. I know from time to time the same could be said at the set of cities, counties, and townships of legislation we pass that affects them as well. And Mr. Chair, if we might, there is a 468 amendment to the bill that we need to adopt as well, and most of them are technical changes in order to conform, and I think probably the biggest part of the amendment is page 2, the last line 16 through 26, in which they're trying to make this provision going forward, so it would be for violations after August 1st, 2005. And I think this was an important consideration in order to get the Teamsters to support the bill.
Any questions about the amendment? Not. We'll move the amendment. And in favor of the amendment, 0468, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
A050468 is adopted. And,
Mr. Chair, if I might, Mr. Drexler, Mr. Gerdesmeyer, and Mr. Hausladen are here to speak to the bill as well, depending on the time that the committee would like to spend on this bill.
Okay. Who's first? Can you identify yourself with the state, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Drexler. I'm the Division Administrator for the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. That's Drexler. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that the chair or the members of the committee might have at this time, where the bill came from or any history, or where the law came from or any history behind the law.
Are there any questions for Mr. Drexler?
Mr. Chair.
What is your name?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Drexler, I would like to know the history of the federal law and what precipitated it and what violations were done by the states, because it affects all states, not just Minnesota, and how many states have complied now with the legislation And were they the primary violators of the federal law that they jumped on board first? Or are we are a major violator and we're behind the dog here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Chairman or Chair Anderson, it has nothing to do with what Minnesota did or did not do. The Commercial Motor Vehicle Act, the original act, was passed in 1986. And Congress, at that time, it was looking toward one driver's license. In other words, you had held a driver's license, and that was going to be your driver's license. And if you lost it for whatever reason, you were going to you would not be allowed to operate a commercial motor vehicle anymore. In 1991, the ICE-T bill, the federal transportation bill, Congress passed the requirement that then the Federal Highway Administration, now the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, was to oversee the state's adoption of that. Well, in 1998, many of the chair might remember a very serious truck-train crash down in Illinois, just south of Chicago. A high-speed commuter rail was heading northbound. A commercial motor vehicle driver went around the gates and knocked the high-speed commuter off the rail. I think approximately 14 people were killed in that crash. Congress went back and revisited the law. At that time, by the way, the commercial driver, Illinois had a masking provision which you'd go in on the weekends and take a course or something and keep points off your driver's license. And at that time, the Congress got wind of the serious crash, obviously, and legislation was proposed called the Motor Carrier Safety Improvement Act of 1999. And the act revisited the Motor Carrier Safety Act of 86 and our agency's enforcement of that act and the state's properly carrying through. And it also added several different amendments to the CDL requirements at that time. Many before you in this bill today. We, the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, passed regulations in conformance with the federal law, and that came out in the summer of 2002, requiring the states to adopt these new amendments to the Motor Carrier Safety Improvement Act, and that's where it stood. That's where we stand here today. It's been 3 years, and we're working with the state of Minnesota for information for this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Drexler. Couldn't there have been something like a threshold in the law to say that if a state reached a certain level of not compliance or, you know, committing problems within this area, that would trigger then the legislation to put it in place? I mean, I don't know right now. I haven't researched this enough to know what we have complied or not complied as far as CDL driver's license in relationship to the law. But I'm just thinking that, you know, this is bang, bang. It, you know, you got to have it in place by the fall. And it's a major impact on the finances of the state if we have it, don't have it. And I'm just wondering why we couldn't have, you know, sweetened the pie or let's have an incentive of some sort or a threshold whereby the state, if it could meet that threshold, then we would, or if we didn't meet the threshold, we would be put into the situation where we had to follow the legislation.
We're in a position of negotiating with the federal government here, are we? I mean, doesn't that come down to the fact that Congress is selling us down? And if we were aware of this and somebody could have told us this, we might have negotiated with our own Congress people here as how we were going to vote on this. But right now, we're not in a position to negotiate as far as I know, are we?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I want to say don't kill the messenger here. It is a situation where I am simply carrying forward the wishes of your federal constituency in the passage of their laws. our laws than the federal government. I suppose it, in answer to Mr. Anderson's concerns, I suppose something could have been built into the law. There was nothing built into the law, sirs, ma'am. So I don't know how else to answer that question.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Reeder?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Drexler, maybe you could correct me, but I believe the entire bill basically deals with commercial driver's license, not with ordinary the other classes. And I think that's maybe a little confusing. Initially, I thought it was different, but part of the problem has been because of between the states, sometimes they lost one of their driver's license and they'd operate on another one nationally. That was a real problem, I think. I guess as I look at this, on a CDL problem, one of the major ones we have in Minnesota deals with that agricultural exemption where you changed on the 200-gallon tanks and some of the 10,000 to 26. Yeah, it was 10,000, but it was 26,000, went down to 10 now. So that just about every farm operator would have to have a CDL to pull a towed fertilizer tank. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Becker,
members of the committee, built into federal law right now, there are some exemptions from farmers as long as they operate within 150-mile radius of the farm and transport commodities normally used for the farm that would be considered hazardous materials. That's considered that exemption would still stand. There is no real difference as far as federal law goes, as long as it's within that 150-mile radius of the farm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, sir, would you like to have a word?
If I'm up. Mr. Chair, member of the committee, my name is Don Gertesmeyer, and I work for the Minnesota Teamsters. And I'm not going to have to take a lot of time today. In fact, there's not enough time in this hearing. There probably isn't enough time in this week for me to tell you how much I object to one driver's license. There's a lot of reasons, but commercial drivers are the only segment of society that what they do in their private life affects their ability to earn a living. And that's just not truck drivers. That's a lot of other people that have a commercial driver's license. Be that as may, that's a fact of life. If you're going to drive commercially, you're going to operate under occupation that requires that. There are a lot of regulations that go with that. And the department contacted us in February and asked us if we'd come in for a series of meetings. And a representative, this was heard last year and didn't pass because it was another year. It was another year of grace period. That's why nobody took action last year. But through a series of meetings with the department, what latitude they had, they extended to us. And there's a look-back feature that came out very, very well. We think it's fair. But overall, this bill, it's tightens the regulations some more. But if Minnesota doesn't do it, and we aren't allowed to issue CDLs, you guys can find the money someplace else. But if we can't issue CDLs, that's a hardship on our membership. There is a possibility, I read, and I'm not sure how accurate it is, but some states may take a position that they're not issuing non-resident CDLs, which would make it extremely difficult for our Minnesota people to get a license. So I don't want the minutes of this to reflect the Teamsters saying, this is a good bill, we support it. This is a bill that has to be, and we're not opposed to it.
That's fair. Any questions for Mr. Gertesmeyer?
Yep, that's right.
If not, Representative Reeder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Mr. Gertesmeyer, part of the problem now, you're going to keep it on the record for 10 years. In your opinion, does that affect probably disproportionately your CDL licensees compared to another one as far as the insurance record goes? One of the reasons the Dimler Amendment was passed because it appeared, at least to the basis of people that said they needed the Dimler Amendment, was the insurance companies were keeping, it was a public record and they were looking at it and increasing premiums for those that had multiple traffic violations. Does that affect your CDL in the same way?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leader, there's a 10-year look-back period and it depends on how it's set up, but I think probably either the federal transportation people or the state should answer that, but it stays on your record for 10 years. Or it stays on indefinitely for the CDL. It never goes away.
Vice Chair.
We're talking talk about alcohol-related things.
All right, there's one more witness. There he is, Mr. Hassan. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We went from Drexler to Gertesmeyer to Hauslad, and you have great names here today. You've heard a lot of the content about the bill, so what I want to say very simply, first of all, that I'm John Hauslad, I'm president of the Minnesota Trucking Association. We are a membership-based organization that represents over 700 trucking companies of all shapes and sizes and their key suppliers from across the state. And we have unionized members and non-unionized members. We do strongly support the passage of House File 2063. And the heart of the issue for us is the ability to issue the CDLs. In fact, with all the trucking issues that you've heard us talk about this session, failure to act on this provision in this bill is probably going to have the most negative and immediate effects of all the issues we're working on. So we do urge you to pass it. And I guess just to try and put it in a slightly different context, imagine for a moment that the impact would be on Minnesota if the state lost the ability to issue licenses to doctors or dentists or nurses. We could not license them in this state. What would that do to our ability to attract those professionals and provide the services that the citizens need? It would be dramatically impaired. Well, losing the ability for this state to issue CDLs would really be no less dramatic. If you think about it, 7 out of 10 of Minnesota communities rely exclusively on trucks where the drivers hold the CDLs to haul everything that goes into that community and everything that goes out. In fact, on a daily basis, trucks haul 700,000 tons of Minnesota freight. CDL drivers haul 700,000 tons of freight. I think it's fair to say that the CDL is an underappreciated and an undervalued license that is essential to keeping the wheels of commerce moving. So I think I can sum it up to say that we believe it is essential. It is our license to do business. We understand that there are other issues involved with the bill, but we think it would be pretty devastating if we could not get this done this year. And as an industry, we want to be safe. We want things to be on the record. We do oppose, as an industry, masking provisions, and so we support the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Mr. Hauslad, and again, my concern is a look back and the problem we had prior to the insurance company. If a person that had a CDL had, and I drive the interstate every week a lot of miles, and sometimes their speedometers aren't calibrated like mine, I can tell you that. And if they get a speeding ticket and it stays on their record, does that also revert back to their, when their primary vehicle other than the truck? Would that apply as far as their insurance rates go affect their insurance on their personal vehicle?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leader, as Mr. Drexler said, when they changed the federal rules, they created, in essence, just one driver's license. So an offense in a passenger vehicle affects your ability to hold a CDL. The amendment that you adopted actually is for offenses after August 1 of 05, so the look back is not 10 years retrospectively, but it'll be for any offenses that occur after August 1.
Any other questions or comments?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hauslad, it talks about commercial motor vehicles and having worked in the agriculture industry, and I know that the former boss that I had at one time used to bring in college kids to haul fertilizer bags, chemical bags, and things on a fifth wheel out to the operator, or whether he might be on the farm or whatever location he had to do. Would that be considered a CDL? Would that person have to get a CDL to be able to work at a commercial situation like that on the farm? Or
Mr. Drexler, I'm looking for a nod or a...
Depending on the size of the truck and the relationship to the farm. It could be a limited CDL, but
Mr. Chair, members of the chair, members of the committee. They could get a limited CDL, but for all intents and purposes, the truck is over 26,000 pounds gross vehicle weight rated, and or pulling a 10,000 pound trailer that would require a CDL, and right now requires a CDL for those types of operators.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Drexler, according to this language, you've deleted the gross weight of 26,000 pounds that's been deleted out of the bill. So it says is of any size and is used for transportation of hazardous materials. Because I know in the agricultural field we transport hazardous chemicals, according to the EPA, this now, it says, there's not a vehicle weight of 26,000, it's any size of vehicle that's for transporting. So to be able to utilize a part-time person for an internship, they're going to have to get a CDL to work there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the federal law requires a CDL for any placarded amounts of hazardous material. I think Ms. Abu can explain more in her bill where those things link, but as far as the federal law goes, the federal government only requires a commercial driver's license in trucks less than 26,000 pounds when the vehicle is required to be placarded by federal law.
I just wanted to add that there is a provision in our law for a seasonal farm CDL, or seasonal farm license, so I think that would address your concern. I could look that up and provide information for you with a section number. I don't have it at my fingertips.
So, Mr. Chair, didn't get your last name.
Albu.
Okay, I'll go with that. If a farm person wants to come in from his farm to pick up chemicals and he has to get a placard to be able to take hazardous materials from the farm co-op back to his farm to you said the person has to have it placarded on for hazardous chemicals.
If it's a farmer, and there are some limited exemptions for the farmer not to have placards on their truck per federal law. Those are an existing... I got to go back to an earlier preemption of Congress in 1995 preempted the state's hazardous material regulations and made one hazardous material regulation for the land. So that's the Code of Federal Regulations, Title 49, Parts 100 through 199. There is no more state hazardous material regulations. There are some limited exemptions for farmers for placarding. Very limited exemptions in certain quantities, and that's a current law on the books right now. The CDL simply brings in, when Congress passed the CDL, they had to start somewhere and address what level they wanted the commercial driver's license to go down to. The level that Congress chose in 1986 was placardable quantities of hazardous materials. But as I stated earlier, as long as you stay within 150-mile radius of the farm and you're a farm or farm employee, you don't need a CDL.
Okay.
Are there other questions or comments? If not, Representative Hurley, would you like to renew your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would move that House File 2063 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance.
How about public safety?
Oh, I'm sorry. Public safety.
Yeah, that was...
You're right. This okay. Is my fifth bill of the day. So I'm a little fried.
Well, you just want to get a name in the committee, yes, since you were here.
Mr. Chair, actually, I do not, and if members want to plug their nose when they vote yes for this, they certainly can.
All those in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The bill is adopted, and motion prevails, and the 2062 is on the way to public safety.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Yeah, is he here?
Yeah, it's tracked right.
Representative Beard,
yes.
Thank you all for coming in and testifying. House File 1730.
Yeah.
This goes to the Federal Register. I move House File 1730 be recommended pass and be referred to the General Registry. Representative Byrd.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for your indulgence. I had another interesting place to be at the same time. But today it was only two places at once instead of three, so it's been a pretty light day. What you have in front of you is a resolution memorializing the President and Congress to support Amtrak funding. Mr. Chairman, this year's presidential budget recommends that there be no Amtrak funding, I believe, for long-distance trains. I think there still is Northeast Corridor and some commuter work in Southern California. But I have a gentleman, Mr. Thomas Dwyer, who would like to speak a little more authoritatively to this resolution, if I may introduce him to the committee at this time.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Dwyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. It's been, I spent about 8 years since I come over here to say a few words. I used to spend a lot of time in the Capitol for over 20 years. And I'm a retired railroad worker.
Would you identify yourself with the tape, please?
Tom Dwyer, a National Legislative Director for the National Association of Retired Railroad Veterans.
Thank you.
As Representative Byrd pointed out, that the administration proposed no money for Amtrak for fiscal year 2006, which commences on October 1st of this year. And if that being the case, then Amtrak would go into bankruptcy. And we believe, railroad workers across this country, that we need a viable passenger system, as well as we need roads, waterways, and airports. And Amtrak recently, in recent years, has been cut back so far that they don't have enough money to maintain their bridges and tunnels and so on and so forth. Amtrak only owns land trackage in the Northeast Corridor. They don't own any trackage range across the country. And the proposal that's coming out, we believe, in the next week or two, regarding to Amtrak, if you want passenger service in the state of Minnesota, such as the Empire Builder, the state of Minnesota would have to pay half the cost to maintain that service. And I know the state will have that kind of money to pick up the cost. From the perspective of railroad retirees, 22,000 railroad workers live in Minnesota. 17,000 are retirees and their families, and about 5,000 are active employees. We all work under the Railroad Retirement Act. And Amtrak is also an employer under the Railroad Retirement Act, and those 19,000 to 20,000 employees nationwide pay into our pension system. So that is our concern about maintaining Amtrak as a national mode of transportation, along with the highways, the waterways, and airports. Thank you for your support, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Representative Byrd or Mr. Dwyer? Representative Izalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dwyer, I'm just I'm curious, how much do we make a profit with Amtrak, and or if we don't, how much do we lose each year on this?
Well, the last year's appropriation was $1.4 billion for Amtrak. Amtrak will never pay for itself at the fare box. No national passenger service in Europe or Japan pays for itself at the fare box. We approach it just as a system of another mode of transportation that we need in this country, because I recall during the tragedy of 9/11, Amtrak was the only system that was running in the country, and most of the politicians were riding the trains from New York to Boston. And we believe that Amtrak should be part of that whole program. Thank you.
That's true. It's our public transit systems, not only railroads, but your light rail and your buses and all that, so they all have to be subsidized.
That's correct.
Any other questions or comments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and Representative Byrd, thank you for bringing this forward, and this is really important, and I guess I wanted to get a sense of, you know, what are the prospects right now in Washington. You know, it looks grim, but I know in the past we've had, you know, similar cuts that have been, you know, beaten back, and we still have our service to Seattle and Chicago. What could you just give us a quick thumbnail sketch of the Washington politics right now?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to defer to Mr. Dwyer to answer that, since I've had my hair on fire with other issues than Amtrak lately.
Mr. Weinstein, I'll try to answer it this way. We have bipartisan support in Congress. Congressman Oberstar, for example, was a ranking member of the Transportation Committee in the House, and Don Young, the chairman of that committee, the Congressman from Alaska. Now, we'll have lots of support for Amtrak in the House of Representatives. Now, we do know that in the House Budget Committee last week that there was $1.2 billion that was put in the budget resolution, which is not enough, but we asked for about $1.8. $1.2, which is unspecified and unmarked for, we believe it's for Amtrak. On the Senate side, we didn't have any money allocated in the budget resolution. But we have bipartisan support on Amtrak in Congress. We just got to work with the administration to get something done.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dwyer, the money that was allocated last biennium for Amtrak and the money that's coming that would, if we can get this passed, does that also take that money go into taking care of the pension for those retired workers?
Yes, it does.
And how much is that, Mr.
About $300 million a year.
For all those retired workers?
Well, for the workers that are working, plus Amtrak as an employer pays into the same fund.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Dwyer, it's not just $300 million for the retirees, it's for, also for the workers.
That's correct.
That are working.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Otherwise, I will remove my motion that House File 1730 be recommended to pass, and I will move for the review of the zoning register. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same size.
Opposed.
The 1730 is on its way to the zoning register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Can we take it then? Okay. Representative Olson, let's see, what's the name of the bill? 1818.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move House Bill 1818 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Transportation Finance Committee.
Okay. Please.
To the bill, Mr. Chair. I'd like to begin by first giving just a little bit of history of where this bill comes from.
Where does this
come from? Over the last couple of years, in the debates on the North Star Commuter Rail train, I've been working, as many of you may recall, to keep the North Star Commuter Coach bus operating. It comes up to the Elk River area, which is just south of my district, and 2 years in a row I introduced an amendment on the floor because the issue was not addressed through the committee process, and we managed in a coordinated and a cooperative effort with local government in this last round to keep that bus operating. And through that process, I learned that there were operators out there that felt that they could actually operate the system without any subsidy if they just had a little bit of help. And the help I'm trying to come up with here is tax exemptions for operators who would provide daily commuter service, not a charter or anything like that, just a daily commuter service to provide them the support to be able to establish this kind of service anywhere around the metropolitan area. I always felt that there was something wrong about pushing for something just for my backyard. And it always bothered me that these systems are so expensive that we have to take them in such piecemeal. And from my experience in working with this issue, I found that there seems to be a possibility. I believe there is a possibility that we can actually get something going where areas all around the metropolitan area could have a commuter service, express service, and have their needs met all over right away within the year, instead of everybody having to wait and having only service in some particular area. So what the bill does in Section 1 is creates a license tax exemption. I've sunsetted all these exemptions to about 25 years. wanting to assure that this works, but gives them enough time to plan a business and see that it gets up and going. Hopefully by that time it'll be so profitable that we wouldn't even need these exemptions. It assures, and this question came up with Representative Holbert's bill when it came through, recently passed on the floor. It assures that they have use of freeway shoulders outside the metropolitan area with department oversight, corporate income tax exemptions, and gasoline and special fuel tax exemptions are all provided with that 25-year sunset. And lastly, the use of bus stops so that when they're bringing people down to the metropolitan area, once they enter that Met Council area of service, the Met Council is required to reasonably work with them to allow people, so in a way that doesn't interfere with their schedules, so allows people to be dropped off and provide passengers for that Metropolitan Council system, the Metro Transit system. That's basically all the bill does, and I'd appreciate members' support.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and Representative Olson, I think you have a good idea here. I think it's almost like a transit, the transit, if you will, and given the pressures for funding transit, I'm hoping that this will at least get to my committee so that we can take a hard look at it and see about including it in the omnibus bill. Chair Earhart expressed his concern about the tax issues, and certainly if this is included in the omnibus bill, the omnibus bill will make a stop at taxes before it heads to Ways and Means. And given the number of finance provisions that have been presented relative to transportation that involve taxation, I am assuming my bill is going to taxes anyway, and we're planning for that in the timing of our omnibus bill. So, members, I hope that you can support this so that the Finance Committee can take another look at it.
Representative Horstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Representative Olson, are there any costs to Metro Transit to this bill? For example, additional maintenance of these stops and other facilities, and do you foresee any direct competition between Metro Transit and this particular line that you're trying to support? Because then we're really I worry about the public costs of that. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, and members, a very good question. Given the stage in this process that we're in, and that none of these exist yet, and we're simply trying to put something out there to bring entities forward to provide the service, and I mean, we're talking about a paradigm shift here. And to your first part of your question, at some point in time, if there's enough use of this proposed system, I could see the argument being made that there might have to be some maintenance costs covered. But at this point in the process, we're really trying to basically test the environment. I got two bus companies that tell me they could do this, and they're looking at running numbers in their businesses and monitoring how this goes. I had intended on having one of them here, but they weren't able to attend on the notice I was able to give them. But I hope that we can do that in finance. So that's on the first part of your question, that is a possibility, but I think it should be de minimis at this point. It shouldn't be a problem. On the second part of your question, I do not anticipate any substantive competition from the standpoint that you think of the Metro Transit jurisdictional area and think of my area and where we're really trying to provide service. I anticipated this question somewhat and apologize that I didn't have time. I need to really look for, and I'd be happy to work with you on this.
Sure.
I need to look at the bill more closely and try to see if we can't come up with some language to make it very clear that we're talking what type of a commute we're talking about, because we're trying to come from Big Lake, St. Cloud. They're talking about a run from St. Cloud down. And granted, if they go all the way to Minneapolis, there'd be some competition for that last little leg. But given the nature of where they're going to and from, I can't imagine why we'd want to make people stop and suddenly get on the Metro Transit system and do all those stops to do their last run. And I personally wouldn't consider that competition. Because we're so much outside their area of jurisdiction and area of service, I should say, I wouldn't consider that competing, but actually given the fact that you'd be taking a busload of people from St. Cloud or Big Lake, and we'd still be dropping them off downtown or some major center, their system is going to be supported with more riders because you still have to distribute those many different passengers around the urban core. So at some point in time, you might call it competition, but overall, I think we're going to be supporting that Metro Transit system. It's a very good question. I hope that provides a sufficient response.
Thank you. That is very helpful, Mr. Chair and Representative Olson. Thank you.
What keeps the folks who are running these companies from cherry picking, i.e. picking out the routes that are most profitable and don't even make a profit? Because they're only willing to accept those routes where the people want to ride and fill up in the morning and whatever.
Representative Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I'm begging your pardon. Another good question, and I've had some components of this idea for a couple years, and I've struggled with how to get this going. As I mentioned in response to Representative Hornstein, we're really talking about a policy change, a paradigm shift, and how we operate. And because nobody's operating like this, and so many people out there in the marketplace really feel, well, this isn't even doable. I'm trying to put something on the table, put something in statute, and see, you know, what kind of marketplace response we get. If many come forward to provide this service, we will have a competitive issue to deal with in the next session. But if there are not that many, and so far, of the bus companies I've spoken to, there really aren't very many that are even interested in this because they don't want to compete with Metro Transit. They don't want to deal with that. Because of the nature of that environment, I don't anticipate that to be a problem, but at this point, but maybe 2, 3, 4 years from now, that could be a problem that we would have to address. And I'm certainly open to working with members on language to address that concern if we could now. I just found it very difficult to address that concern until we find out what we can actually get done.
Is there any governments on any of this, or are they just... They can go anywhere, wherever they want, and there's no routes or anything they have to follow.
Mr. Chair, members, the marketplace will really determine the routes. The governance that we do have is in Section 2. It's very advantageous, as you know, for a bus operator to have use of shoulders, and the department will basically be controlling the routes to some extent by where they're willing to provide this access to shoulders. So between the marketplace and that shoulder access, which would be very advantageous to an operator, there will be some governance and some control of where these systems operate. But even to that point, depending on the size of the bus, and council could clarify this, there are various sizes of buses. And if you think in terms of the various passengers or the 50-passenger bus, you got 50 cars off the road. A lot of people... And this is what I've struggled with over the years. They think more buses on the roads means more congestion. Well, that's not true. This kind of system proposed is really a system based on the fact that it already shows numbers of being profitable. So if, in fact, they reach that threshold, we're talking about already knowing when we put the bus on the road that we're going to take 50 cars off the road. That will not increase congestion. That's going to reduce congestion. So I feel like to get this started, we just need to open a door and invite some people to come through and let them struggle within their businesses to see if they can provide the service, find the marketplace. I'll tell you, I believe so much in trying to do this from what I've learned over the last 2 years that I paid for out of my own campaign pocket, if you will, ads in the two local papers, quarter-page ads, inviting people to tell me if they want to ride an express route from Big Lake or St. Cloud down to Minneapolis or St. Paul. We need to find these people. I believe they're out there, and I believe when you think in terms of what it costs just in gas to go from Big Lake to Minneapolis, it's just in gas, it's almost $2, depending on your mileage on your vehicle. It's just about $2 more than we are charging on the North Star Commuter Coach bus. That doesn't account for everything else on the list, cost of the vehicle, parking, you name it. Just gas alone. We have arbitrarily lowered the cost of these bus fares so much The paradigm out there in the marketplace is nobody can provide the service and never will. I'm trying to change that because I firmly believe, I know I would, if you give me service, express service to St. Paul, reasonable times where I can make it, I'd pay the money. I'd pay the money to ride. I like transit. I'd use it. But we've changed the paradigm and I think prevented people in the marketplace from really making this choice. And I think it's tragic because we're causing congestion with these kinds of policies. And is this the best approach to change it? I don't know. We can debate that. But we need to take some steps to open the door, to invite the marketplace to respond and provide services all over the metro area because we can't afford to wait for the different systems that we're planning to put in place. We need stuff now. And that's why over the years I've really advocated for keeping this bus going, which almost failed 2 years in a row, and we still have to deal with the issue again this year.
Representative Leader. Oh, excuse me. Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Representative Olson, I got a little problem with your semantics. You say not subsidizing. We just passed a bill. And we took what was a fee and says it's a tax, and we've got a lot of bills that are taxes, and we call them fees, and you say you're not subsidizing. I'm okay on all of that, but I think you would say we are subsidizing. Anytime we subsidize the extent you're doing here, that's big bucks. The other thing that you're forgetting about, we may be subsidizing with highway monies here. Because as I understand and I've driven from Big Lake or from Elk River, from wherever you're at, there's not a highway shoulder that's built for buses till you hit the metro area. So you're going to put, supposedly you're implying you're going to put buses on those shoulders. They have to be rebuilt. That's highway monies. I just wanted to make sure we understand some of those things. It's not a free lunch. And I would hope you don't use the word we're not subsidizing because that's absolutely wrong. It's a pretty big subsidizing process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Leader. I very much appreciate your comments. You are right on track. That's a very good critique. My comments were not intended to mean we're not subsidizing under this bill. My comments were, and I didn't state this accurately enough. Your critique is valid. But if you look in the bill on page 2, line 15, without financial operating assistance, okay, that's the qualifying factor for this subsidy, if you will. Now, in response to the concern of this subsidy, if we don't provide this subsidy, we have no service. If we provide the subsidy, we may have service at a savings to the state because there's no operational subsidy. So we do get ahead. Granted, your point of the shoulders is right. It's a good critique of the bill. But what I'm really saying here is I think it's a policy mistake for this institution to not have provided more shoulders all over the metro area. Let's take the 394 corridor. All the money we put into that corridor to serve that corridor. If we'd put more money into shoulder capacities all over the metro area, we might have service all over the metro area to address this fact. The fact being, depending on who you ask, 10 to 20% of commuter trips are to downtown. 80 to 90% of commuter trips are suburb to suburb. By looking at our entire system and providing shoulder strength to allow for this kind of a system, we could simply expand the metro transit system in a viable way that could actually be cost effective. And I regret that this institution did not provide the shoulders to do this. By starting here in a small way, eventually we will run into that problem. Your critique is good and valid. And I hope at that point, if we find that this is successful, it'd be worth our while to invest in those shoulders instead of putting such large amounts of dollars into single little corridors to serve single areas. And I appreciate your comments. And would appreciate members' support.
Are there other comments or questions? No.
Yeah.
Representative Gonzalez. Please.
Most of my questions were answered. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Olson, the question I have, or Representative Olson, the question I ask myself is, what if it worked? And if it worked, we'd reduce congestion, and since I rent a house up in Brooklyn Park, this would be great. We'd create more jobs, and as I look at it, it could be like UPS and the post office. I mean, it caused them both to be better, and so I don't know they would work, but to not pursue new ideas, I think, is a mistake.
Thank you.
More questions or comments? I personally would like to lay this thing over for an interim study because I think it's got so many holes in it that it's beyond repair. But the chair of the Transportation Finance Committee really wants this, and I know that Representative Olson wants to get it over there. And
Mr. Chair, if I might, we could assign you this bill as homework over the next weekend or something. You can get it all fixed up and have it ready for the omnibus bill.
I already can write the paragraph. Yeah. All right. Representative Olson, you want to renew your motion? Let's see. Yes. Please.
Mr. Chair, members, I will renew my motion that House Bill 1818 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the state, to the Transportation Finance Committee. I've been in too many committees today.
All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign?
No.
Wait a minute. Before I jot that down, that's close. I think I'll take a hand count. All in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
You wished it was close.
And opposed.
Just kidding, Mr. Chair.
Sorry.
10-7? I got 11-7, but whatever the difference is. It passes and found its way to Transportation Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Well, we still have a bill. Do we have an author?
I won't.
Yes. Ah, Representative Wilson.
And it's the one you've been looking for, Mr. Chairman and committee members. It's the last one of the day. If we'd done that one first, we would have been done a long time ago. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House File 1402 to pass and move on to public safety.
All right. That's the motion.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, as you know, Pete Nelson from Josiah County, the Swedish Riviera, as I always say. This bill deals with teenagers driving with and using a cell phone. And one of the things I was talking with my wife about is even my grandson, how I see him driving is kind of like this over the steering wheel, kind of like that. And I think we see that with a lot of our young drivers. The Insurance Institute for Highway Safety notes that the risk for motor vehicle crashes is higher among 16 to 19-year-olds than for any other age group. In fact, for miles driven, teenage drivers age 16 to 19 are four times more likely to be involved in a crash than older drivers. But even within that age group, teenagers that are 16 years of age are almost involved in a crash as 19-year-olds. So even within their own age group. In the year 2003, Ford Motor Company, on their virtual test track, did a driver simulation. Very interesting results. The average driver missed about 3% of the simulated driver distractions. Teenagers missed 54%. 54%. The teenage drivers were more susceptible to in-car distractions than adults in all areas. And it's due to their inexperience. And it's also due to, with that inexperience, they choose to travel much closer behind other vehicles than we do. And because of that, that showed that 50% higher rate of distraction and problems. Because of that, young drivers give themselves less time to respond to dangerous conditions. Younger drivers allow an average of just 1.3 seconds stopping distance from the car in front of him. Experienced adults maintain at least a 2.2 second gap. What that extrapolates out into is that gives you an extra 90 feet of stopping distance at 65 miles an hour. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says that 25 to 30% of all crashes are distraction related. Again, the statistics show that teen drivers are responsible for 14% of traffic accidents, even though they only comprise 7% of the drivers. According to Liberty Mutual, only 15% of teenage drivers claim they never talk on the phone while driving. Only 15% say they don't. And they're a lot smarter than me because not only do they talk on them, they're text messaging all the time too. And I don't know how the heck they do that, but they do. That's another distraction in there. In fact, in the year 2003, in June of that year, the National Transportation Safety Board recommended that all states pass laws prohibiting inexperienced drivers from using cell phones while driving. Now, there is a bright note for you legislators. Politicians manage the unlikely feat, serious, this is some of their studies, but politicians manage the unlikely feat of ranking in the top five of speeding violations. How about that, huh? But at the same time, politicians rank in the bottom five of accidents. Now, the only other group within that study that ranked in the bottom five of both accidents and speeding was homemakers. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd stand for questions, but I certainly would appreciate support on this particular bill. It certainly is something that is not a big onerous thing for drivers that are learning how to drive. I think you can see before you that there are penalties imposed if they do violate. There also are exceptions allowed for emergency situations, and if you do get stopped, you have that opportunity to plead your case.
Representative Hoover.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Nelson, have you thought about an effective date for this in order to train these kids that this is the new law, and for kids that have already gone through driver's training and maybe driving on a permit already, or have you thought through that?
Well, Representative Holberg, Mr. Chairman, and members, my feeling is sooner rather than later. I really believe that if this passes, that like other bills that will pass out of here, the August 1st implementation date works. I did, Mr. Chairman, if I might, and members, also had a conversation with somebody that makes a pretty good living on cell phones. It's T-Mobile. They stand in support of this type of legislation as well. And so I think that's important to note, too.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, I like your bill. I'm going to support it. I simply question whether or not it goes far enough. And tongue-in-cheek, what would you think about an amendment where we simply change your bill to read that the holder of a driver's license shall not operate a motor vehicle while talking on a cell phone?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newman, what I think on that probably isn't as much an importance as the practicality of it. I honestly believe that we have the real possibility of passing this legislation through. It has passed through in the Senate, and it is going to be attached to one of their bills. My understanding is an omnibus bill. And I think that's important that we get this much taken care of. Again, keep in mind that what this bill deals with is 7.5% of those that have driver's licenses, but those that create 15.5% of the automobile accidents. Now, you want to compare that to adult driving, Representative Newman, and let's pick my category in the 55 to 59. We represent 6.7% of the drivers, which is pretty close to 7.5. that will account for only 4.2% of the vehicle crashes. Fully a fourth, only a fourth of those. And I think what we want to do as a legislative body on legislation like this, my personal philosophy, is that we have to take care of the very important part, the very important needs first. If we want to come back next year, the year after, whatever, when we see the results, that's the time that we should deal with that.
You know, Representative Nelson, I think that Representative Newman will have his way with a big debate if this gets to the House floor and there's some amendments floating around. You will be probably very much in tune with some of them.
It'll be a hot time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Now, I was going to say I have the effective date next week because my oldest is starting to get a temporary training. But seriously, I was going to make the same point that Representative Newman made, and I think that Representative Yaros had legislation to do that. And I don't know, I don't recall it actually getting a debate, but I think it's a good bill. I'll support it, and I do hope that we can pass this year and then work towards an overall ban on cell phone use while driving. I did have a quick question, Mr. Chair, for Representative Nelson. Are you aware of other states that currently have something like this already on the books? I know there's a couple that have the overall ban. I think New York State does, but are there any other states that have this just for the younger drivers?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hornstein, I'm not aware of any particular ones, but I think that that's what important is not who does have it, but more important who does not. You remember my testimony earlier about the recommendation from the National Transportation Safety Board. They want all states to pass this type of legislation.
Well, then I hope we're the first, Representative. Thank you.
Today is never soon enough, and we don't want to be waiting much longer.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Questions have already been asked, but the one question I do have on the penalties that you put in the bill here, are these a recommendation from the National Safety Transportation Board, or is this something from the public safety sector? How did you determine your fines for this particular bill?
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Anderson, we used the provisions that are currently in statute for petty misdemeanors, the 169.89, if you'll notice that, as our starting point, and proceeded from there for second and third violations. You'll also notice in the third violation, members, that while the fine is up to $300 and the suspension goes for 1 year, or until they're 18 years of age, whichever comes soonest. So in fact, they could probably have a license suspension for a month and pay a $300 fine if they violate this late. But when we look at the statistics that I read to you, even within the teenage driving group, the likelihood of an accident and a distraction of 16-year-old is much higher than they are when they get to be that 18, 19-year-old age.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, have you had a chance to talk with the law enforcement as far as the enforcing of this provision and how difficult or how are they acceptable in this whole area?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Anderson, they have not spoken to me at all as far as any opposition whatsoever. Every contact that has been made has been, go get it. It's a good provision.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lyson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson. I have some similar concerns as it relates to the questions that Representative Anderson asked about the penalty. We heard a bill in the last week or so regarding primary seatbelt offenses with seeing a fine significantly increased, and yet this fine is significantly higher than that, and I guess I'm uncomfortable with that. I think that especially since at least some of the safety folks that have testified to me or have visited with me have told me that that while cell phone use is the latest distraction within the vehicle, it's not necessarily, it's not proven to be any more distracting than operation of the stereo or the CD player if someone is choosing to eat their lunch or dinner in the car. And so all these things sort of contribute to the distractions and to accidents. And I guess as we move forward, I hope, I won't make a motion today, but that we would use this as an opportunity to provide some lesson to our young folks and not be quite so punitive in the fines. And so I would hope that at least we could work on that as this moves forward so that we don't hit the hit these folks quite so hard in the pocketbook.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, two things. My recommendation was that this move to public safety, and if you'd like, I'll certainly work with you on that. But just FYI, Representative Larson and others, a 2003 study from the University of Utah showed that conversations on hands-free phones are just as distracting as on handheld phones. And the cell phone use leads to what researchers call inattention blindness. Excuse me, a little distraction there, Mr. Chairman. A study by the University of Toronto, which was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, reached the following conclusions. Using a cell phone while driving led to a fourfold increase in the risk of an accident. Using a cell phone is distinctly more risky than listening to the radio, talking with passengers, or eating a sandwich.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Larson,
I appreciate that information, Representative Nelson. It's just a testimony that I had heard from our Minnesota Department of State Patrol had relayed to me that perhaps some of the distractions that one occurs when they're trying to operate their radio, when they're changing channels, when they're looking for the next CD to put in the CD player. I think all those things are distracting, and I think we ought to encourage people not to be operating any of those things in the vehicle. And you know, I'm as guilty as anybody else of talking far too much on my cell phone when I'm driving. And sometimes, you know, sort of reflect on that and think, you know, you get to where you've gone and you wondered how you got there. You're so busy having a conversation. And so I think that's good, and I want to support this. But I just think that $150 on a first offense and $300 on a second is just too much, and that's and so that debate can continue and will, but I would submit that I'd be, you know, much more comfortable with something quite a bit smaller than that. But I appreciate your offer to work on that, and hopefully we can find something that works for everybody.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This is quick. I just want to concur. I think that's too high. I'll vote for it, but a 16-year-old doesn't have all that much money, $50 or $150s. Either way, they don't want to pay that. So I will support this. If we went farther than that, I'm not sure I would support it for people over 18 unless we saw some real documentation from insurance companies that it saves rates, and it, as of yet, has not. And so that's my 2 cents.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, I'm sorry if I missed this, but your statistics with regard to the youth, was that in this exact age bracket, or did that run up into 21-year-olds and so forth?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, I gave you a number of statistics. I gave you some on people that are my age, and but as I started off, it was 16 to 19-year-olds,
okay,
and then specifically 16 compared to 19-year-olds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only thing is, when we were at the U of M, they do the research in conjunction with the DOT, and they talked about what they were finding is that really it wasn't just the cell phone, or it wasn't just the food, or just the radio, newspaper, take your pick, but it was a combination, and I'm just wondering if you had any research on that.
Representative
Mr. Chairman and Representative Ruth, I think probably If I reiterate just the part from the Ford Motor Company on their virtual test track experiment, the driver simulating, it found that the average driver misses just 3% of the simulated driver distractions used during the test. Adults dialing a handheld cell phone missed about 14% of the distractions, but teenagers missed 54% of the distractions. And so members of the committee know some of these things that when they test you on these virtual driving courses, they'll even have virtual billboards and then ask you what the billboard said or if you saw any of them and some of that type of stuff. So it is the ability with computers, and we've seen that at the University of Minnesota with the simulators, they can do quite a bit of documentation. So I hope that answered your question.
Other questions or comments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, in your statistics, did they have anything did a survey on teenagers dating and that being a distraction? In the
No. But I'm sure it's out there, Representative Anderson, and I'm sure you'll attest that it is a distraction. So
I will attest to that.
I think that according to statistics, homemakers should be our next target.
Mr. Chairman, absolutely not. Homemakers should be the last target. Far and away, far and away, the best ones, by far.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay, any other questions or comments?
Just to renew my motion, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I think we had about everybody asked me questions, except maybe two or three committee members, so it was a lively discussion. I would renew my motion that this be recommended to pass and move on to public safety.
Let me ask if anybody in the audience has any pros or cons on this. If not, why... all in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
I like this.
Thank you, Representative Bornstein.
Motion passes and the bill's on the way to public safety. Once again, no meeting on Wednesday, April 6th, and we'll meet again on April 12th. Thank you.